What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Javier Bastardo is best known in the Bitcoin community as a Cointelegraph journalist and educator for the Satoshi in Venezuela project. Javier Bastardo, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
How are you, Cedric? Thanks for having me. It's a really great pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, I'm doing great. I'm excited to talk to you. I've heard you on several podcasts now, and I'd love to hear more about you and what's going on in Venezuela from your perspective. Can you tell us a bit about what life is like in Venezuela right now, just everyday life for you or just anybody?
Well, as we are living through the global pandemic, everybody is locked down. We are in the same situation, but as we are not seeing people getting the vaccines, because the vaccines are only for the Maduro supporters and the political elites. So the pandemic is hitting really hard. Our economy was collapsed, but the pandemic is making it really worst. Like, people is struggling. Like, I need to go out to the streets, but if I go to work, they could make me go to the jail. So many people are facing this kind of shows. Yes, and besides the pandemic, the economy, maybe as we are adopting the dollar as a de facto currency in the country, is I am almost tempted to say that we are making a little bit better since we are kind of dollarized, but the struggle is around all the country. I think that as I'm living in Caracas, I'm not part of the large majority of Venezuelans that are facing an economic struggle. I can't tell as it is happening to me, but as my mom is part of this group, my mom is like 70 years old. So she earned a little, like $3-5 a month, as she was working here and she received this. So it is really hard to see how, if you are an elder, you are old, an old person, you probably thought that you will be spending your last time really cool, maybe traveling around the country. My mom bought a house back in the day where she came from, and she didn't use that house anytime because the services in that place, that is Zulia, are the worst in the country. So as I can tell by my experience, everything is bad, but I'm not living the badness. But my mom, my family, friends, I know that the country is having a really bad time. So yeah, that is the reality right now. And we are trying to figure it out how to live in this new kind of normality where the regime makes you to make things 1 week and the another week you have a full lockdown. So it's really hard to see how the things are playing with the pandemic. Like the COVID fits like a ring to the regime. They have a lot more control than we have back in 2020. The situation is really hard. They could enforce any kind of measure that they want to cover that we don't have gas, that to cover that in many cities in the inside of the country, you don't have services. So it's the nightmare of a statist regime, the authoritarian regime, with working also with this pandemic narrative around.
Right. What has the process of dollarization been like? Has this been an accelerated process? Is this happening in phases and kind of steps? Do you notice signals or kind of see flags around you?
Okay. Today, I'm not as affected as many of the Venezuelans, but back in the day when I was younger, like I was in the college, I was studying, so I didn't have a lot of money. But the dollar was like really elite kind of currency. Like if the Bolivar is working, I'm talking like 2008 or 2009. I don't know. Maybe, yes. And the dollar was not that normal back in the day. And the process was from the criminalization of having dollars to today is the currency that we are almost using every day, at least as unit of account. Okay, the process to make this, let's see, like 2010, we started to see some kind of inflation. The Bolivar is losing its relation with the dollar. But from 2016 to from today, the economy, the exchange between the Bolivar and the dollar just skyrocketed. The dollar is destroying the Bolivar almost. And we don't have back in the day the relation with the dollar. As I said, it was from elites, from people that always had money, maybe people that are familiar to the global economy, or they understand how the dollar works. But as we struggle with the inflation, and as with the process of the inflation develop to hyperinflation, like 1,000, 2,000% of inflation annually, or maybe in 6 months, this is it's really thought to see. And when you start to exchange your bolivars daily, and you start to see how to play and who you will exchange, because you are exchanging your money, you need to trust your counterparty. It's like circles of trust, how to build a network of trust to exchange dollars and all this. In that early stage, I think that there was a little group of people that are working with remittance. The diaspora of Venezuelans haven't even started. So as we enter to the cycle of hyperinflation, people flee the country, people inside the country get used to the dollars, and they get familiar to how maybe not just hold the dollars, but also how to expand, because as we are not the ones that print the dollars, we don't have all the kind of bills to make the little transactions in the daily basis. So it is a long process, maybe not that long, but it's a process that have had a lot of different stages. And as we are today, we have a lot of problems to spend the dollars. Like if you have a dollar bill of $100 bill, and you don't want to spend the whole bill because you maybe want to keep a little to make another buy, or you face the problems to exchange those, how the merchant give you the dollars that he is supposed to give you and all that. And we have different pseudo dollars, like crypto dollars, like reserve, like it's a shit coin from Europe. Like it's having a really good time here, as they have their own stable coin. The tetherization of the economy is something that is happening, as Binance make a really good enter through the Venezuelan market, and they offering these products with no fees. Like they were pretty similar as what the people are using in the traditional markets, like Zelle, that is a thing that is from the US, but it's really popular here. So as we are facing the problems of jumping from the dollar as a store of value to go to the streets and spend it, we are looking to these all other solutions, Value, PayPal. We have the competitions of the best dollar, because the people really want dollars. Maybe we can make the case of Bitcoin as a store of value. I understand it. I live through this kind of standard, but it's my case. The majority of people wants dollars, right, and understand the store of value problem solved only by dollars. So if you can create like a kind of pseudo dollar, a kind of stable coin, anything that relates to the dollar, you will be able to get a little attention at least. So the de facto dollarization is happening mainly in the transactional economy. We don't have, we have little bank accounts in dollars, but the average Venezuela didn't trust the banks, so it's like not having them, and it is problematic to use these dollars in the banks because they don't have a compensation camera in the central bank. Could make we can all make payments between the different banks in the dollar accounts, mm-hmm. but we are facing the problems of adopt a currency that is not the currency of our country. And the main problem is that the regime, that the government that is supposed to maybe make this easier, they don't see like want to dollarize the economy at all. The Bolivar is really good to them to control the people, to even money laundering through Bolivar, dollars, petro. You have this kind of structure of money laundering. And the people that is developing the remittance all around this dollarization, and with the diaspora of Venezuelans living abroad, they also need the Bolivar to arbitrage the different currencies that they have, like, I don't know, Colombian pesos, Chilean pesos, and the Bolivar here, and what is between dollars, Bitcoin, stable coins, whatever, but they have this percentage that they could make their business. And yes, it's a really complex process, but at the end of the day, it is working. The people is, as I said at the beginning, maybe it is really weird to say this, but we are having maybe a kind of better times with the dollarization, because it is a hardest currency against the Bolivar, of course, and to adapt better money in the daily economy seems to help the people, but we have really, really deep poverty scenes in the country. So this is a really complex process.
Yeah. By adopting another country's currency, does that create positive and negative ramifications that were, you know, that you're dealing with or just see? Do people have a positive attitude towards the US dollar and therefore maybe America, or maybe negative attitudes around what happens in America and therefore what happens to their dollar?
No, I think that the relation with the country is zero. Like, right. We only need the dollar. If the euro could be more popular, maybe we are dealing in euros. And you have, for example, in the borderlines, like between Venezuela and Colombia, the Venezuelans are using hard pesos, Colombian pesos, like as their currency, even more than dollars. So you see that it's not about the country that is used the currency, but about the currency itself. Like, I don't want to hold the bolivars. Right. It is really hard to make transactions between people that probably are working with the land. They have cows, they make cheese, I don't know. Working with the land. And then try to transact in bolivars. If you don't have internet, if you are struggling to make the electronic transaction, it is really useful just to, well, I will pay you with pesos if you are in the borderline, or maybe with reais if you are near to Brazil. Mm-hmm. So it's not about the country that creates the currency, okay. But okay. To use it.
Yeah. What is it like, let's say someone has, you know, they've worked all month and they have a few dollars or whatever would be considered a decent amount of money to go procure some consumer goods or food items. How hard is it to get, or easy to get, things like bread, milk, and eggs? If you have the money, whichever currency is working in that area, is it really hard? Does it take a lot of time?
That is the key concept. If you have the money, you will find whatever you want here in Venezuela, whatever you want, as if you are living in America, because it is really cheap to import things to Venezuela. And we have a lot of bodegones that are like merchants that import different products like Nutella, like some cereals that are really American related, and they are selling there here as a kind of like, you can find whatever, but you have to pay the price. And if you don't have the money and you are earning bolivars, or you are, I don't know, a public worker, you will struggle because the people are earning like less than $5 a month. So you may have another ways to make money. You may have to be creative to survive. They are surviving, really surviving. But if you have the money, if you are living good, you are earning good money, I don't know, like a freelancer, like you are working from some company abroad the country, it is really easy to get anything, and especially in Caracas. Maybe in other cities or other parts of the country will be hard and more expensive. Even when you can find some things that are produced in the area, and those could be cheap, things like rice, things like some grains or stuff like that, you will pay extra, even if you are really near to a production zone like, I don't know, Merida, like Táchira, that are really productive zones, you will need extra money to get some other products that are arriving here in Caracas more easy and more faster, maybe because if you can control the situation in Caracas, you can like make us everything is okay in the rest of the country, even though it is not like that.
Right. And yeah, I'd love to talk more about what's gone on in the country, especially over the last 10 or 15 years. Can you tell us a bit about how Chavez came into power and the transformation in the country during that period?
Okay, I was really young when I was 7 years old when Chavez arrived to the power. So I don't have a lot of memories about the time before the Chavismo. Like all my life, I've been ruled by the Chavismo. But the key issue that the people was having before Chavez is the same issue that we are facing today, that is the economy struggle, earning too low payments and facing too expensive prices in the market from food, from services and everything like that, but in a very, 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 very tiny scale compared to what we are living today. So you don't have that big movement of people leaving the country in the 90s. You don't have that. This is a Chavismo kind of thing that is happening. And also the political situation was that we had like two big parties controlling all the things, that one party ruled for 4 years, then the another, and they were doing this. So the citizens feel like the institutions are really, really far away of them, like we are doing today, but again, as a little scale as we are facing today. And also the political elites was really old and was really disconnected of the reality of the main Venezuelans, the majority of the Venezuelans. Like they didn't understand what the people was facing, as we are seeing today. Like the Chavismo turned on what they swear to destroy. Something like that, that they are today what leads them to the power. So Chavez came to the power in 1998. I was 7 years old. I don't really remember a lot of things about that early stages, but you have this 2002 coup d'etat. Where Chavez was kept off the power, but he returned, and after that we simply go through the shit because he understood like he can't handle many of the elites of the military, many of the elite related to the oil production, to PDVSA, et cetera, et cetera. So he radicalized and changed everything. And the other key factor was when the opposition of the Chavismo left the Congress. They left the Congress to the Chavismo. Yeah, you can do whatever you want with that. And they did whatever they want. So they make legal many of the things that drive us to the thing that we're facing today. So that was when Chavez was alive. I think that there are other things that could be like important to the story, but I think that the next one is the death of Chavez. When he died, we thought that maybe we can get rid of the Chavismo, but that was very naive. Like they was really prepared to the case if Chavez died. As he passed, Maduro was like the chosen one of the Chavismo. Like Chavez said that you have to vote for this guy, and people voted for him, and then he's not like a politician, like to you can say, well, he had experience in, I don't know, that he was just chosen by the big guy before him. And well, after that, the country, I always say that Chavez is the origin of all this destruction, but he passed it, so he didn't face all this shit. But it was inevitable that this we were led to this present, even if Chavez is or not the president. So Maduro is just maybe a scapegoat. Like, we can blame him because, he's the one that is there, but this was inevitable to have this destruction in the country. And he's not a little about leave the power. They already spent too much time in power. Like, they don't understand how to be without the power and are not about to leave the power in any time soon. The control of the institutions, the voting system, the security, the mobility, everything. The Chavismo has the full control of everything in the country. So it's like the last phase of their strategy. They have full control of everything. Like I said, after the coup, they moved to a more radical position that is what we're facing today. We don't have a real opposition. The leaders, the political leaders that maybe are trying to face, that are trying to really face the Chavismo, that are not co-opted, will be in jail or simply flee the country before go to the jail. So we are like alone with this band of bandits.
Yeah. So in terms of these two figures, and I'm not well versed in either one's history and what's happened in your country. I'm trying to learn here, but I do hear some things and I just assume it's filtered or whatnot. But is Maduro sort of the passing of the torch from Chavez in the sense that they're just carrying on the same playbook, or is Maduro a better or worse? When I use better or worse here, in terms of their goal for control, is he more of an effective leader at seizing control or a less effective leader at seizing control?
I think that they are fully related. Like, they were looking on the same goal, because the narrative around the Chavismo is like, rich guys are fucking the poor guys, so we are here to save the poor guy and to govern to them and help them to evolve and control the markets to help the poor guy and all that. So as they are doing that, they are really related, and the necessity of control, like really right. Control the things that are happening around. And
is he really good is he good at seizing more and more control? Is it you think, I don't know what how old he is. Do you think this is an extended, does he have a chance for an extended reign? Or do you see his power slipping away due to ineptitude?
No, I think that he will have, the Chavismo will have an eternal reign in Venezuela. We are turning in a new Cuba, like the Castros. Mm-hmm. Like the Castros spent 40 years, Fidel died in the power. So we are facing that kind right. of struggle. Like, even though Maduro could leave the power, I think that we will have earlier his son of the daughter of Chavez as president before something that is not aligned to the Chavismo. The situation is that hard today. I don't see any kind of solution where the Chavismo is the pose of the power. Even when we had in 2018 this Guaido, Juan Guaido affair, like he went to meet Trump, he collect a lot of the international support and all that, and I thought, yes, this is our moment. No.
Can you explain even that with, moment a little bit more?
Okay, I can't remember. It was in January 2018. I think that is what the date, or 2016. I can't remember. It is, but we had this president of the Congress, the last Democratic Congress that we had, because we have elections, but they are all co-opted elections. Like, it's the Chavismo with the mustache, the Chavismo with lens, and the Chavismo, everything is the Chavismo in the elections. But the last one that we have, that we can say that was Democratic election, an open election, we can participate not really basis. We have the president of that assembly that said that as the elections of president that Maduro had to make in the months before, and as the constitution said that, he as the president of the Congress will have a new presidency of the country, like he is the acting president, something like that. So we have those presidents since that moment. And in the first month of that, everybody said, yeah, Guaido will lead the change. Maybe we are having our shot against the Chavismo and everything like that. But after years passed, the movement simply died. And yeah, they have all the control. The Guaido is still in the streets. Guaido is still being around, but he don't have any kind of traction on the people. And if we are changing all around the world to a more digital world, making political change through mainly digital world in a country where the ones that have the control are really good with killing people, like they don't give a fuck if they have to kill someone. So it is kind of weird to see any kind of change in the near term. And also, we are like totally disarticulated. Like, we don't have a leadership in the people in the country is not so convinced to play in the institutional games, as they know that they are co-opted by the Chavismo. And the Chavismo is just making this happen. And they could stay in power without doing anything, like just holding.
I'm kind of curious, and this would be pure speculation on your part, but a lot of revolutions, especially in South and Central America, are predicated on the notion of the group who's going to oust the powerful group that's ruining it, and sort of using power for destruction or not for the best purpose, and sort of this altruistic revolution. And then they sort of, what you pointed out before, they become the thing they're trying to oust. So do you think in the case of Chavez that and Maduro, that they think they're doing the right thing and it's just was turning out the correct way? Or do you think they set out to do the right thing and power corrupted, or this was a seizure of power from the beginning?
I think that this was a seizure of power from the beginning, but they had this kind of idealistic plans that, as I said, in the 80s, 90s, people was facing almost the same thing that they are facing today, but with elites that are really far of the interests of the common citizen. And but I don't really think that Chavez or Maduro or any of the Chavistas give a shit about the people in the country. I don't really think that it, like, if you maybe you see if he was from a little town and something like that. But no. I don't think so.
Yeah. I'm trying to gather a little bit more background on maybe how bad things get or gotten, or I don't know if they are as bad or worse, but from what I'm gathering from Wikipedia, like, things got really bad in 2016, 2017 in terms of riots and violence and starvation. Are those, is that accurate? And has things gotten better since then?
Yeah, I think that the worst year for many of the Venezuelans was that 2016, because we have two things happening, like the destruction of the currency, like the destruction of the individual economy, but also the lack of products in the market, like the prices goes really up as part of this combination of the two things. And also we had like gas shortages, like problems with services, but really bad problems in that moment. And also there was not as big as it is today, the dollarization. There was no, back in the day, the dollar was not that common. So yes, I totally agree. We also had some riots, people closing their own urbanization, their own zones near their homes, and try to make pressions to, that's the problem. Why are you doing this? What is the plan? What are the articulated things that we are going to do to make this a part of something bigger that never existed? But yes, I totally agree. I had to be careful for where I'm going in that moment. Like, even in Caracas, where are you going? Because in some places there was closed, the people was in control, and people was crushing or fighting with the police, the Guardia Nacional. So they had this, like this big, the last big riot that we had. Because as the pandemic take the whole control, everything is digital. Mm-hmm. It is really difficult to articulate something to make a change, mm-hmm. like a change that in some moment will lead to violence, because I don't see the Chavismo leaving the power peaceful. So it is really hard to articulate something like that only from the digital world. And that was the last moment when we saw what was needed or what is needed to overtake the control again. That it is accurate. And after that, even when the hyperinflation gets worse, you have this kind of like better situation, because you can find the products. If you have the money, you can pay them. If you have the money to pay a good internet connection, you will have it. Those things lacks back in 2016.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious here on two points. One, do you think there were human rights violations during those years? And my other question, and I'm not advocating for state-on-state violence of any kind, but do Venezuelans, and I'm not asking you to speak for yourself solely, but and not to speculate on behalf of others, but do you think Venezuelans wish the world would get involved in what's going on as Venezuela? Or as a Venezuelan, are you happy the world is less involved, and even though things are bad, you should figure it out on your own? I'm trying to sort through that.
Can you repeat me the first part of the question?
So the first one is, were there human rights violations?
Okay, yes.
So were there things that were done that, you know, the world shouldn't stand by on?
The Chavismo is a regime that is a systematic human rights violator. This is not a thing that happened once. No, this is happening today. There are people that are spending time in jail because of a tweet. There are people that are spending time in jail without having visits of their families or friends. There are people that simply died in some strange circumstances, like, whoa, he died. Oh, amazing. There are tortures. There are a lot of systematic violation of human rights. So we are facing one of the worst situation of the institutions in Venezuela. Like, it's not only the economic collapse of the whole country, it's also the lack of freedom and also the continued and systematical human rights violation. This is part of the everyday in the country. Recently, we have this embargo against El Nacional, that is the oldest newspaper in Venezuela, and they embargoed their main building, their main house, the main place, because of something related to the honor of Diosdado Cabello, because El Nacional published a piece that was originally published by El País, that is a Spanish newspaper. And because of that history that turned it down to be inaccurate, they embargoed the El Nacional. So we don't have freedom of press. You don't have many speech or press freedom. You don't have the right to protest, because we have something that is the hate law, the La Ley del Odio, that was right to criminalize the protests. So they have full control over any action that you can make as a citizen. And also you have the menace that you could make, like, if you go to the streets and protest because you don't have water, you could go to the jail. And if you are jailed in these conditions, you probably will spend months waiting for a trial, because they don't have how to make this happen. But as they have the hate law, they can make you through the jail. So we are facing many different ways of human rights violations. We have people that are working with NGOs that are trying to help people in critical situation, that are trying to help the elders, adults, that they don't have the way to maintain themselves. And those people were jailed too, just because they were helping the people, and they are doing a work that is supposed to be done by the state. So yes, we have a really bad situation in human rights, in the human rights area. And also about, if I want the international, the other countries around the world involved. I'm living in Caracas, so I think that could be really dangerous to ask for people to come here and bomb Maduro and fuck him. And I don't want to get murdered, even though it could mean the freedom of the country. And I don't think that that's the right way to have the freedom of the country, because we will have really great things to pay to the countries that help us. So what is the cost to have a removal like that?
Right.
But in the other hand, I really want the people to understand how deep is the crisis that we are facing and to step up in some ways, at least like in a diplomacy way, like yeah. we could have more pressure. The sanctions from the US are not really working, but maybe we can have some that works the better. Many of these guys have prices, like the guy that is on the Sonacrypt, that is the regulator of cryptocurrencies here, have a 5 million price from information that lets to get him. Maduro have 15, I think. Same to Diosdado. So they already have even a price. And those things are not working at all. So it is bittersweet, because in one hand I am tempted to say yes, get rid of that guy, but in the other hand I'm living here. I know people that are really near to the place where it's supposed to be bombed in the scenario. So the human cost of something like that could be enormous. And also, we are in the 21st century, you know? So it is really hard to think that is the only way. Like, there is no right. other solution to this thing. Well, after some years trying to figure it out another way, it seems like it could be the most effective. We don't have other choices. And if we try to go through the democratic path, the all the institutions are co-opted. If we are trying to go to build a political movement path, we are probably going to jail. Like, I could make a Bitcoiner party and maybe start to talk about freedom and make a new liberal party, something like that, that could probably lead me to the jail. So why I will bother to do that?
Let's say you had a friend come over, or you go over a friend's house and you just have a meal together, not a big party, nothing official. Do these kind of conversations happen in private with your friends about, like, will things get better? Do we want things to get better? Or do you just, everyone talks about other stuff?
I think that everybody just is used to this shit. Like, it's hard to see that you don't have any other choice. Mm. Like, it is really hard to see that there are any kind of leader around that could help to make a change. It is really hard to see, like, as a people, as a group of persons, you can't build a movement because it could lead you to be in danger. So I think that people simply avoid that kind of conversation. Like, why we are going to talk right. about something that is kind of impossible?
Is it a form of self-censorship in that regard and a win for the powers to be?
Because I think that more than censorship, that auto-censorship, that could be, it's more like I want to simply live. Like, it is bigger than me. What can I do? So we're in that stage, like the citizens didn't really see that they have any kind of powers.
Right. I'm kind of curious, we were talking about the embargo before on the press. Do you deal with a lot of propaganda, or what you feel is very, you know, feel is very overtly propaganda?
I left to read Venezuelan press or anything like that because they are full of propaganda. If you live in a country that is as polarized as is Venezuela right now, you will probably see some news that are related to some to one party and news that are related to the other. But where is the truth in that? You will never know. I stopped to read them. Like my main source of news is Twitter. And you don't have to spend the time to see, yeah, these are aligned with the regime or these are pro-oppositions. The main problem with the embargo to El Nacional is like, that was one of the last, I think that we have like five more media like could be considered open to talk against the Chavismo. But this was the oldest one. And also the way that they're solving that issue that is linked to the honor of Diosdado is like, oh, holy shit. They are doing this like killing the enemy. Like, I don't like that guy, so kill him.
If I were to visit the country, would I need to take, would I be able to fly in? Would there be a preferred method of entering the country? Would I need to take extra precautions as just a normal traveler, you know, someone?
You know that Peter McCormack was here last year or the 2019, I think. And if you don't travel as something that could lead to the suspicion, like you are going to do something spy, something weird to the country. No, I think that it is really normal to came here. The main thing that I could say to anybody who is able to make it to Venezuela is to be really careful, because if you are talking in English or you seems to be too alien from the main Venezuela, it could be problematic, because we have I don't know how to say it's ladrones, ¿cómo se dirá ladrón? Thieves. We have a lot of thieves. Like, yeah, it is. It could be problematic to came without knowing anybody in the country. Like, if you know somebody, like, could help you to be in a good place and could help you to make some visit to some places, it's really okay. But by your own, I don't recommend it.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. But I want to turn a little bit to the petro again, back to currency. And where does the petro fit into the economy? And I'm just going to preface that with, when it was launched, I expected it to fall flat on its face. So I just want to know where it is, what its role is right now, how do people treat it, and maybe compare it to the Bolivar.
Yeah, we have this pseudo cheat coin that was launched in late 2016. And they said that it will be built, then they move it to NEM, then the project was launched as a fork of Dash. They had a lot of technical problems, like bugs, like I said, that you're transacting from like 1789, something like that, and many, many technical problems. So from a technical perspective, the petrol is garbage. From the economy perspective, as I said, they have full control of everything. They have the power to make some uses of the petrol almost mandatory, but the market is not really buying into it. Like, the nominal price of a petrol is $60, but in the market you can buy petrol with 15, 10 bucks. So you see that the market not aligned, that the market is not confident with the tool. And as they almost had that in their hands without any kind of useful way to spend them, they are fucking the workers, because they paying bonuses to the people with petrol. So let's say that at the end of the month, I will give you a bonus, like $20-$30, but in petrol, and in the nominal value of the petrol. So if they are 30 bucks, will be half of petrol. But when you are going to the market to spend that bonus, that as a worker, you probably will need that money, you only will have a half of the nominal value that you are supposed to receive. So it's I think that is one of the worst inventions that the Chavismo could ever make, because people that are today, there are people that trust the Chavismo. They are Chavistas. They are people that are supporters, Chavista supporters. And they are paying that support with this shit that simply they are paying with something that you can spend in the way that you could desire to spend. And they are making you to think that this is a kind of favor, that you are resisting something, that you are facing the United States Empire, that you are a patriot because you are receiving this. This is bullshit, you know? It's hard to see people trusting them and being scammed like that. And even though cheering from the Chavismo, saying, oh yeah, this is the best government in all time, it's really weird to see. Right. So in short, the petrol is dead. they are using it to pay from their own people. They are also using it to laundry a lot of money. They have some exchange that works with that, and though many of those exchange are known for work with illegal money, like they are laundering with the petrol. They are the only ones that pay the petrol in $60, the nominal value. Why? And why only to people that are aligned to the Chavismo? Why again? yes, it is a corruption tool. It is a control tool. Technically imperfect tool at all.
Is there any merit to it as a crypto? Is there a block explorer? Is there a node you can run? Can you validate the supply at all?
They have a blockchain, but it is not functional. They have a block explorer, and you need to have hashes of transactions to see at least the movement of some direction, but you don't see the last blocks or something like that. Or you can run a node of petrol in your house. It is closed. I don't know how many nodes are, because the guy that knows the most about this, because he worked in the early stages, he recently passed from COVID, so we don't have so much information of what happened. And it is worse than a cheat coin, because with cheat coins maybe you can say, well, you can see here where how much you need to spend, or how many transactions are in the blocks, or, but with this it's not the same, and the data that you could find is not as accurate as should be in a blockchain system.
Right. And what backs the Petro, supposedly?
The Petro is backed by oil and a basket of different precious metals, gold, diamonds, lithium.
Well, what's the oil, specifically with the oil? Is that oil that is out of the ground already? What's the story with the oil?
It's a promise of 60 million of gallons. So I don't know which is the unit, but the barrels, 60 million of barrels that are in the ground in a petroleum camp that is registered under PDVSA, that is at least is managed by the state, but it's only a promise. Those barrens are under the land.
Right. And is that like clean oil or like easily refined oil?
Extra heavy.
Right. And does Venezuela have the industry or capacity to even refine this oil?
No, because as these guys are tempted to think that the money is infinite, they didn't even save money when we had the boom, the petroleum boom back in 2006. They didn't save any kind of money, so the oil industry simply continued to decline. Like in the beginning, we can make 2 million or 20 million barrels a day, and today it's in the order of 100,000.
Right. Well, I would like to turn to Bitcoin a bit and just hear more about how did you find Bitcoin? And if you could tell us a little bit about how you found Bitcoin and we can go from there, but I'd love to hear your rabbit hole story.
Okay. I was looking for a new job.
2016, like I was figuring out how to survive the inflation that was rising in that moment, and I make a contact with some in cryptonoticias.com, that is a website in Spanish about cryptocurrency news. And I started with them in January of 2017, before the bull run, the previous bull run. So I saw all the room in that moment. And I started there writing about all the space, not only about Bitcoin, but also about cryptos, about ICOs, about blockchain, blah, blah, blah. I started to earn Bitcoin because of that work in like October, November of 2017. And that changed all. Like when I started to earn Bitcoin, I started to understand what the hell I was working all those months. Like it is different to report something in a kind of aseptic work, in an aseptic way, like write about something that you are trying to just see with objectivity. This kind of journalist lens that they, I'm philosopher, my background is in philosophy, so I'm not that sell to this idea of the accepted and objectivity of the journalism. But in the start, I was doing my work in that way. But when I started to earn Bitcoin, that changed everything. Like, I started to understand the importance of something like Bitcoin. Like, I am in Venezuela, and many ways of receive money from the outside world could be difficult to cash out here. But with Bitcoin, you don't have that problem because it is really liquid in this market. And the other thing that made me realize that Bitcoin is what it is important was the start of the bear market. Like in 2016, I was making PRs to Dentacoin, to even Binance, many, many projects that was just launching. And I was reading their white papers. Not, that was not like I'm just reporting on this. No, I was reading information about them, trying to figure it out what is the product, trying to make in the case to write a good PR. Like if you are doing something, even if that kind of work, do it good. And in 2018, when we start to see those projects die, was really game changer to me because I was really sold to the idea of the necessity of decentralized many things, like make everything decentralized to blockchain, using smart contracts to help the poor people and help the gun controls, the climate change, et cetera, because back in 2017, that was the cool movement. But in 2018, when I started to see those projects die, I was like, what's happening here? What's happening? Why everything is dying, just dying? Yeah, because it is really difficult to create something that disruptive just with a kind of technology that you don't really understand. This could be blockchain in that moment. So I started to focus more and more in Bitcoin. I start to avoid interview people of shitcoin space because they are only here to sell you something or to make friends in the media business or stuff like that. I stopped to join them, to talk them, etc. And in early 2019, I was a maximalist from that movement. I started to write with Cointelegraph too. I had a problem with the people in Crypto Noticias because they said that I have interest conflict. I was in two big papers, so I have to choose. And I stayed in Cointelegraph and started Satoshi in Venezuela, Bitcoin only project, educational project in October of 2019 with support of Blockstream, Bull Bitcoin, Samurai Wallet. We had a lot of friends in that moment, Len.io. The start of 2020, I stopped to write about Bitcoin with Cointelegraph because I was writing only opinions columns, like a pundit, and I started to focus more in Satoshi in Venezuela. That almost all my rabbit hole journey, and I think that I had a special way to enter this scene because I didn't make it through the market. I'm never traded. Like I couldn't make two trades in all my time in Bitcoin. I don't was because of the money, because I was working, so I was paying to report the things that are looking. And at the end, I was sold in Bitcoin because it solved something to me. Like I need to earn the money that I was earning through something that I can cash out here. That was the main impulse in the beginning. But when I continue earning in Bitcoin, when I went through the cycle, like I had some money and the bear market made that money like only 30% of that value, to understand that, to make me comfortable to that volatility, even though you have the Bolivar volatility that makes the Bitcoin volatility like a baby game. You have to change the way you see things. And I think that the key thing with Bitcoin is the freedom that it gives you. Like I understand that the Chavismo have the full control of the whole country, but they don't control my money. Yeah, I could lost my money. I could say, yeah, I lost it. I could make it by my own way, by my own mistakes, not because they are making me lose it. And with that lose of money, they are making, getting stronger in their control over all citizens. I can avoid that control. So it's like I discovered something more valuable that I was thinking in the beginning when I started to be in a relation with it. And as far as I understand that, and when I started to compare it with the things that are around that I could use, I keep the Bitcoin thing going.
Yeah. Wow. Do you have hope for Venezuela? And I'll kind of embed in that. Does Bitcoin, you know, you hear the expression Bitcoin fixes this, fix the money, fix the world. Do you think Bitcoin can help Venezuela? And I'm not talking about as for payments or for people to use as a store of value, but its existence in the world. Will Bitcoin's existence in the world, does that give you hope for, you know, eradicating powerful regimes that control people, i.e. Venezuela?
It's really difficult to be optimism in this kind of context because the context is really ugly.
Yeah.
We see really deep poverty things, people starving, people eating from the garbage. And the only thing that makes me positive in this kind of a scenario is to think, like, as I discovered Bitcoin, every other kind of person in Venezuela could discover it too. And as I find the way to avoid the control that I described, they have full control of all the situation. They have full controls of many of the citizens of the country. It's kind of true that could make you, could help you to make out of the of that control. And as I understand that, I'm not special because of I discovered Bitcoin, nor am I special because I understand a little things about it. I know that others can do the same thing. So you can build a movement, a political movement of citizens to face the chavismo, but you can build a little group of Bitcoiners that will understand how deep is this kind of freedom. Because I could flee, I could leave the country. Today I could leave the country, I have the means to do it, but I'm not connected to the reality of Venezuela. Like I don't, I could stay in my house, I could go to some places in the city, even outside of the city, go to some cities in the country and stuff like that. But that is only possible because of Bitcoin, because I was saving in Bitcoin since some time. So I'm earning Bitcoin. I work with people that is outside of the country. So I don't really, I'm not really related to what's happening in the country. So it's hard to see people struggling, knowing that they could be better if they take the time to understand what is Bitcoin, take the time to save some sats, or maybe to change their own perception of what's happening with this kind of money, that you understand that they can keep printing bolivars. But okay, well, no, it is really different when you understand that you could be in a context like this of destruction, of hyperinflation, but you can use a monetary system that could not be affected by the same things. Like they could not print more Bitcoin, they could not dilute the value that you're saving through the time, through your work, just because they understand that they will control better if you starve, if they make your money worthless. So these kinds of problems that are all linked to how the state builds manage the money are not the same problems that you are facing when you are living through a Bitcoin standard. Like I'm living through a Bitcoin personal standard. Like I earn sats, I save sats, I think in sats. And that's not because I'm a kind of a special Venezuelan. Everybody could do the same thing. And we have the process of dollarization that we discussed early. You can see the same process of monetization of the dollar in Venezuela with Bitcoin globally. Like Bitcoin is moving to a phase where it was criminalized, it was only linked to illicit uses, and then it moved to a more normal way to understand it, and now you have Michael Saylor and people like he buying it. The same things that we saw with the dollar, it was criminalized, people saving only and not spending, and now today we are all spending in dollars. We have many things to better understand how to use Bitcoin and to improve our life with Bitcoin. I think that I hope that people discover it as I did, and that's why I'm doing Satoshi Mentora. Like if someone listened to what we're doing there and they have some questions and we can help them to make it to Bitcoin.
It's a little choppy.
And now you hear me better?
Yes. I could hear you.
Okay. No, you can ask me another question.
Sure. I'm kind of curious if you could tell people outside of Venezuela what Bitcoin means to you, maybe for people that aren't going through what Venezuelans are, but just, you know, based on your experiences, what does Bitcoin mean to you?
Bitcoin means way to conquer your own freedom, even in context where you are free, quote unquote free, because we are always tempted to think like our institutions are built from the good, that the people that are leading those institutions are doing the good, but countries like this shows that those institutions are probably, they could fail, and they could fail in a way that you as a citizen will feel like you are too little to care, or too little to make a change or stuff like that. So Bitcoin gives you a way to opt out of those institutions. And every country could become a Venezuela. We are just an example of how the fiat model of economy and currency could collapse. Every politician could be a corrupt politician with a good incentive around. So it is not so distant to any of the countries, even though they could be working mode today. They could be facing hyperinflationary struggle in any time soon. And also, if you are living in a country like this, where you have a tyrannical regime around, where you feel alone like citizen, like you don't have any kind of power, well, this gave you again that power of being at least in charge of, when you understand how deep and how that changed you. Like I don't feel like I could leave others to control my money again. Like, I understand how deep and important that control could be to make me make things, or to make me feel things, or whatever, to they continue in the power, but the people around just having bad times with that control and power. So it makes you to understand how deeply and important money is from the realization of the individual and the realization of the citizen, that I'm not willing to let it go again. Yes.
I hear you. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation. My final question for you is, you know, what would you be doing in a future world where Bitcoin is the standard and people, and including yourself, are more free?
I think that, well, if we find a stage where everybody knows about Bitcoin, maybe things that, like what I'm doing today, that this talk about Bitcoin, make a podcast about Bitcoin and stuff like that, will be not as useful as it is today. So maybe we can focus in other things. But if the hyper-Bitcoinization will need the people to continue spread the word of the message of Bitcoin, I will be doing exactly the same thing. Hopefully in other conditions, hopefully in a country of more self-aware citizens that understand better how they can conquer their own freedom with these kind of tools. So yes, maybe we'll be doing the same, or in the case that doing things like this is not useful.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just, I'm kind of curious what you would be up to you know, in more revolutionary or Renaissance times?
I don't know. I think that if one could, because today my main activity, my own is Bitcoin. I do a podcast, I do something about news, I work with Bitcoin enterprises. Mm. So today all is Bitcoin, but in a more Bitcoinized world, I'm tempted to see me driving through the Bitcoin philosophy. Maybe I could make a philosophical case of Bitcoin.
Is there a piece of Venezuelan wisdom, maybe from more free times that you would wish you could share with the rest of the world?
Well, that every country could face something like this. And as soon as you start to see your president of the people of the political elite flirting with some kind of authoritarian measures, when they get the and it's hard to take it back as citizens, but yeah, okay. But taking mind that every country could be like this, and as far as you see some of your governments or some of your political elites flirting with the authoritarianism, take care, be aware, because the control that they could win, the control that they could build will be destroyed, and that's options to make through the new stages of the humanity, and you could lose the hyper-Bitcoinization phase of our story.
Right. Javier, this has been an incredible chat. I've enjoyed this immensely. Can you let everyone know where they can find you and if you have any parting words?
Yes. And thanks a lot for having me, Cedric, and to the people that listen this. And you can find me on Twitter. I'm there at Crypto Bastardo. But instead of a Y, you should put an I because it is in Spanish. And also you can find Satoshi in Venezuela that at Satoshi, ENVCLA. Thanks a lot for having me. It was a really great conversation. I hope that we can chat in other moment with more positive things to say about the Venezuelan reality. And I hope that the people that listen to this and are curious about what is happening in Venezuela would find this conversation useful. If you have any questions about what we talked here, you can reach me, and happy to talk to you too.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much, Javier. This has been so dope. Javier Bastardo on BTC, hyperinflation, dollarization, and the crisis in Venezuela, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thanks for listening. If you're gonna be in Miami for the Bitcoin 2021 conference this weekend, hit me up in my DMs, or just say hi in person and we can shoot the shit about Bitcoin. In the meantime, keep learning, keep stacking, keep going, and keep your head in the game. It should be a fun one. This is Cedric. Peace.